Actually, David, if you don't mind, if you give me the Birei Chumash, Bereishis Beis. Just need that one more sefer. Thank you. All right, we're starting Peirei Gimel, chapter 3. So as a general overview, halfway through the book of Rus, things start to change in that the driver, the new driver in the seat. The first two chapters of Megillas Rus, who's the driver? Who drives events? Who's pushing things forward? Ruth's. Naomi basically bails. I mean, she's going to leave. And Ruth is the one who emphasizes and insists, no, I'm going to stay with you. I'm going to go with you. And they come to Israel, and they're penniless. And Ruth says, I'm going to be the one to go out there, and I'm going to find food for us, and I'm going to take care. Ruth really is driving things. And Naomi, the mother-in-law, goes along appreciatively. Now, at this point, halfway through Megillas Rus, where we start chapter 3, it's noted that here, Rus is no longer in the driver's seat. She becomes much more, I'm not going to say passive, because she does some incredible things, some very brazen things. She's doing it, but who is the driver? Who's pushing things along now? It's not Rus, now it's Naomi. Naomi, all of a sudden, now becomes very assertive. And she says to Rus, this is what we need to do for you. So that's just something interesting to note of a shift. See, a shift in who is the prime mover and shaker. Rus remains the prime actor. She's doing all the things. She gets the credit. But here, it's Naomi who pushes. This is not any longer Rus's idea. This is now Naomi's idea. And of course, from this point and onward, it's not about Naomi's welfare. It's about Rus's welfare. So when it's about Naomi's welfare, Rus is the one who goes out of her way. She's the one who says, I need to do for you. I need to take care of you. And Naomi's just grateful and says, okay, well, I'll accept that. But from this point onward, the shift kind of moves from the welfare of Naomi, who is kind of settled. She has a roof over her head and she has food. And now the question is, how do we take care of Rus, this young, beautiful princess who doesn't seem to have a future or needs to have a future and needs to get married? Naomi takes the baton, and she begins to worry about Rus and about her welfare. You can't expect Rus to demand, hey, take care of me. Take care of me. Instead, it's Naomi saying, I'm going to take care of you. And that's how the pasuk opens. The first pasuk reads, Vatoymer la Naomi chamoyson. Naomi, her mother-in-law, said, Biti, my daughter, haloi avakesh loch manoyach. I want to seek out respite for you. Asher yetiv loch, so that things will be good for you. Now, what is Naomi speaking of when she says, I want to seek out things for you, I want rest for you? So the Ibn Ezra says that when we say manoyach means this is marriage. Rest is marriage. And somebody would argue about that, but that's that's what the Ibn Ezra says. He says, Ein le'isha menucha ad shetinase. A woman doesn't have complacency or peace until she's married. Elsewhere, the Medrash says the other way around. The man doesn't have peace and complacency. I don't know if peace and complacency is the right word. If you want to be peaceful, go to the cemetery. There's a lot of peaceful people there. Everybody's peaceful, right? So when we say peace, what does it mean? Non-action? Peace means something which is immobile, not moving. What we really speak about, we say manayach, we mean to find fruition, to find perfection in life. And the Torah clearly does not believe that people can find perfection in life on their own. The Torah expects us to be able to develop ourselves fully. Marriage is a key component in that development. So there's a certain point in life where it's no longer about self-development. Young person has to worry about self-development. Young person has to worry about their education, their career, if you will, their focus on life, becoming a mensch, develop, obviously be sensitive and caring and sharing, and you'd be a dutiful child and a good sibling, and it's all nice, but ultimately you're on your own. But there comes a point when you have to no longer be on your own in order to find your destiny in life, in order to find the fulfillment of the passions that life have. And I'm not talking about libido. I'm talking about being able to develop life fully, that from a Torah perspective, that's not achieved on our own. It's achieved through a couple, it's achieved in a family unit, it's achieved through marriage. So marriage is about self-actualization, but a very different kind of self-actualization. And that's what Naomi means when she says, Avakesh loch manoyach. I want to find you respite. I want to find you peace. What is she could say, I'm peaceful. Everything's fine. But no, that's not the manoach that we seek here, is the idea, ein li isha menucha, as Ibn Ezra says, ad shetinase, until the marriage is going to take place. So that's what Naomi has in mind. Now I'm going to read the next couple of verses together with you, just so you hear what kind of outrageous suggestion Naomi has, and then we're going to revisit two things. Number one, the outrageous nature of what Naomi's about to suggest now. It's not even daring, it's off the charts, number one. And number two, to go back to this verse and look at it, because it's actually, although it's a very short verse and it doesn't seem to say much, it's rife with contradiction and is pregnant with enormous amount of instruction and inspiration and meaning. But we're going to go back to that. So Naomi says to Ruth, you know, this is not good. You're a young lady. You're on your own. We have to move forward now. We have to find your marriage. Why all of a sudden now? What happened now? I want to, take you back to the end of the last chapter. In verse 23 of chapter 2, which is the end of Perek Beis, it says, Vatidbak menares boyaz, the young ladies who are for Boaz, they kind of cleave to Rus, and she continued to collect ad klois ktsir hasa'idim, until the end of the collection of the barley harvest, and then uktsir hachitim. We add and not only the barley harvest, but also and the harvest of the wheat. And Vateshavas Chamaisan, she remained with her mother-in-law. And if you remember, we talked about two interpretations, whether it means she actually was there every night and she would walk all the way back to Naomi and sleep with Naomi under the same roof and they would spend time together, or it means that she would be there occasionally. But at any rate, she remained, so to speak, devoted to her mother-in-law. And that we emphasize this is Ad Katsir HaSa'oidim, until the end of the harvest of the barley, and then U Katsir HaChitim, the end of the barley, the end of the wheat harvest. And then chapter 3 says, Naomi says to her daughter-in-law, her mother-in-law, Naomi says, Biti, my daughter, I'm going to look for you for respite, for peace. What happened all of a sudden? Why is Naomi suddenly looking for peace, which we understand to mean marriage? Why now? What happened at this juncture? What happened at this point? So the Medrash Rabba says something very interesting. It's a Medrash Rabba of Rus Rabba, Perek Hei, in chapter 11. So it speaks about the connection that Rus was able to forge with these young ladies and to socialize a little bit. And then it says, Mitchilas Omar Rabbi Shmuel Bar Nachman, Rabbi Shmuel Bar Nachman taught, Mitchilas Ktsir Se'irim, because you mentioned two harvests, the harvest of the barley, and then that concludes, and that rolls into the harvest of the wheat. So he says, from the beginning of the harvest of the barley, ad k'tlois k'tzir hachitim, until the end of the harvest of the wheat, shloish hachadoshim. You're talking about a period of 3 months. She came in the beginning of 3 months, this is the end of 3 months. Okay, so what? And if it's 2 months or 4 months, why is that relevant? Why is it important for us to be told that it's the end of 3 months? So the Marzu says in the name of a particular Rabbi Yitzchak, he says, so Shleisha Chadoshim would mean from Tet Zayin ben Nisan, from the 16th day of Nisan. Remember, Pesach is celebrated on which day? The 15th day of Nisan. When is the Seder? When does the Seder happen? Happens on the 14th in the evening, Eve of the 15th. And if you remember, Naomi had a Seder of sorts in Moab. This is the very beginning of the book. And Naomi made up her mind she would wake up early in the morning. Maybe they drank their cups of wine. Her daughters-in-law would be sleeping, and she was going to leave. That was her plan. And Naomi has the Seder, and she leaves Pesach in the morning. She's out of there. We had a whole discussion. How could she have walked on Pesach? There was an issue of life or death. This is all the things we dealt with in the beginning of Megillas Rus. And then Rus gets up, and she sees Naomi, and she runs after her. Where are you going? And I'm going to go with you. And they arrive in Beit Lechem when, on the eve of the 16th day of Nisan. What used to happen on the eve of the 16th day of Nisan? Everybody was gathered outside. It was an enormous throng, huge crowds. What were they doing there in the crowds in Beit Lechem? So it says that they came to cut the wheat, the barley for the Omer, because the Omer carbon is brought on the 16th day of Nisan. So they arrived on the 16th day. That's when the barley harvest begins. And the first barley that's harvested is Matzah Yom Tov, at the end of Yom Tov, at night of Yom, after Yom Tov, everybody gathers. And there was a mitzvah for it to be done in a big crowd. And here the scripture clearly tells us that's how it was done in a big crowd. The point is now in Shiloh, which is in the area that the world calls the West Bank. Go figure. Our Beis HaMikdash is there for 369 years, and they call it the occupied West Bank. And so Shiloh is where the Beis HaMikdash is, the Mishkan, and they came to Beit Lechem. Yerushalayim was not a thing at the time. They came to Beit Lechem, where the family of Nachshon ben Aminadav, which is the future progenitors of royalty, that's where Elimelech, when Naomi's husband also used to live. And they came to Beit Lechem, and there they came to the fields, and they're going to be cutting the wheat, which is Beit Lechem. It's the house of bread. It's the bread basket at the time. That's where the wheat grew. So the barley grew. So they came there, and when was that? That was the eve of the 5th, of the 16th, of Tet Zayin B'Nisan. So that's the beginning. And what happens? And immediately, Naomi suggests to Rus, you need to go out to the fields, get some gleanings. We're starving. We don't have any food. So when does Rus go out to the fields? On the first day of the barley harvest, after the korban is brought in the Beis HaMikdash, which is which day? The 16th day of Nisan. When does the harvest conclude? He says the 16th day of Tammuz. That's when the harvest concludes. What happens after the 16th day of Tammuz until Sukkot, which is the 15th day of Tishrei? What happens then? So the grain is left in the field. And in the heat of the sun, what happens to the grain? It dries out. It cures. That's why the name summer in Hebrew is? Kayetz. What does Kayetz mean?
The end, no?
It means to dry out, to get cured. So they would leave the fruits out there, and the fruits would be cured. You have figs, fresh figs turning into dried figs, fresh dates turning into dried dates, and so on and so forth, so people could have fruit during the winter. There's no refrigeration. There was no airplane bringing them fruit from somewhere else where the seasons were different. They had dried fruit during the winter, fresh fruit during the summer. And the grain had to be dried out sufficiently. When it came to the Korban Omer, they actually had an issue because the grain was wet. It was still moist. They used to have to roast the grain in the beginning. So then it gets dried out, and then it gets brought into the silos. It doesn't rain in Eretz Yisrael in the summer. There's no, you don't have to fear of any rain. Once spring sets in, that's it. There are no rainy days. So the actual harvest, first is the harvest of the barley, which ripens more quickly. And that's where the first offering, the first korban of meal, of grain, is barley. And that's on the 16th day of Nisan already. And then we don't have the first wheat in the Beis HaMikdash until Shavuot. That's called the Korban Shtei HaLechem. So first comes the season of harvesting the barley, that grows more quickly. And then the wheat takes longer to grow, and the entirety is 3 months. That's the Shlesha Chadashim. So the Pirush Marzu says in the name of Disserb Yitzchak from Augustave. I guess he lived somewhere in Spain. Augustus or something. He says that's from the 16th day of Nisan until the 16th day of Tammuz. Okay, why is that relevant? Why is that important? Because it's a very interesting halacha, that when a woman converts to Judaism, that she cannot marry until 3 months go by. And these 3 months are called Yemei HaHavchana, the days of separation or distinction. So that means, and again, this sometimes it's much bigger than the technicalities of it, but technically speaking, if there were to be a pregnancy achieved, it is not known immediately. When does the pregnancy start to get noticed? After three months. That's when the pregnancy starts to be noticed. Now, of course, in modern day and age, we have ways of telling pregnancy, I don't know, if not within hours, within days certainly. And some of these tests can even be done. It's over-the-counter stuff. You don't even have to take a blood test. Right? So a urine sample could tell, say, whether a woman is pregnant in all likelihood or not. In those days, those tests did not exist. It's possible they could have noticed a rise in temperature. It is possible. It's not impossible that a woman couldn't have known they were pregnant. But it doesn't become certainly not public knowledge or not obvious until 3 months pass. So we have to make a havchana, a distinction between any such activity, procreative activities that happen prior to the conversion and procreative activities subsequent to the conversion. So what happens is there's a separation of 3 months. Now, of course, you could ask a question. So in today's day and age, can we take a pregnancy test? The answer is no, because Rus obviously was not pregnant. She was a widow, and her husband had died months earlier. And yet, the halacha remains is a three-month period, a waiting period. Incidentally, the same thing is also with regard to a divorce, mm-hmm. with regard to a woman who's widowed. There's always 3 months between the period of, so to speak, what was, and then the period of what's going to be. So Rus is a Geyeres. Now, there's two opinions whether the original conversion was valid or was a very weak conversion, and her conversion had to be upgraded. A majority opinion is that Rus's initial conversion was not really a proper conversion, kind of a quasi-conversion that had to be upgraded later when she came to Eretz Yisrael. So she came immediately. It was the first thing she did. She had embraced her people. We learned the halachas of what you have to do to convert from her conversation with Naomi, how Naomi dissuades her and pushes her away, and she says, no, I want to be married. I want to remain with you, even though you don't have a child anymore, that for me to marry, and so on and so forth. And Rus immediately converts, according to the second opinion, that she goes through the conversion, upgrades the conversion, and then there needs to be a three-month period. So had Naomi wanted to look for a shidduch for Rus prior, it wouldn't be appropriate. Really, this is the time. So that's why Pasuk Chav Gimel, the 23rd verse of chapter 2, finishes off with Kalois Ketzir HaSa'irim, the end of the barley harvest, U Ketzir HaChitim, and the wheat harvest, and then after the wheat harvest and barley harvest, so the harvests are passed, and she remains with her mother-in-law. So all time, this is again the last verse in which Rus is the one who is driving the situation. She remains with her mother-in-law. She doesn't leave. And now Naomi feels a burden, a responsibility. She says, I have to take care of my daughter-in-law. I need to do something first. So the 3 months have passed. So it's here that the Ketzir Chitim, that the final harvest ends. Vatoimer lo Naomi. That's when Naomi suddenly turns around and says to Rus, Biti, my daughter, Avakesh lach menoach. I have the responsibility now. I have to take care of you. I have to seek out for you peace, meaning seek out marriage.
Rabbi, I was told that a woman could remarry a month after she loses her husband.
It's not correct. You can't remarry a month after. Okay. It's always a minimum of 3 months. Maybe people can get engaged. Maybe people can, you know, move forward in life, theoretically speaking, but actual marriage always requires a three-month period.
Is it same for a man?
No, because men don't get pregnant.
But 30 days, isn't it for a man?
Yeah, that's something else. So the question is, if a man were to lose, if he could do it in shloshim or not, like, the whole thing sounds very odd, like, but if somebody's in a desperate situation.
Mm-hmm. So it doesn't depend on the age of the woman if she's like 70.
No, that's the point. That's why I said it doesn't matter about a test or not a test. Rus was clearly not pregnant. She was a widow. Nonetheless, there had to be official 3 months of avchana, especially because she was Giyadis. So the 3 months of avchana, 3 months of separation, so that wouldn't make a difference. It wouldn't make a difference if somebody's 90 years old. We would wait. So therefore, Naomi says, the Anaf Yosef in his commentary on the Medrash also says, Shleisha Chadashim Shehi Ad Seif Zman Havchana. 3 months until the end of what's called, this is the terminology in the halachic literature, as always, Zman Havchana, the time of Lahavchin means to make a distinction. Like we say in our morning blessings, Lahavchin ben yom ve'layla, to make a difference in morning and night. So there's the distinction thing. So this is the Zman Havchana. Ki ad hazmanahu lohoysa ru'uy lehinose, Anaf Yosef says. Up until this point, it wasn't appropriate for Rus to be married anyway. So Naomi didn't feel a burden. She didn't have to do anything because it wasn't appropriate anyway. Now at this point, the harvest is done. Now we have an issue. Now we have to take care of this. Now it's necessary, or Naomi feels a responsibility to take care of her daughter-in-law of Rus. Yes? So now, this is the general introduction. So I've given you now two general introductions. General introduction A, we talked about the concept of how the driving changes, the driving force changes, and I give it a background why the driving force would change. Up until now, it wasn't possible, really, for Naomi to do anything. Up until now, it's all Rus. Now, Naomi assumes the responsibility of taking care of Rus so that things work out for her. So let's look at the next few psukim, just so you have a sense of how, for lack of better terminology, outrageous her plan is, what her ideas are, and then we're going to talk about this a little bit. Va'ata, and now she says, Haloi boyaz moidaitanu. You know, he's kind of our relative. So, asher hayisa esna areisav. You were with the young ladies, and presumably that means, you know, you see he took care of you, and he was worried about you. He knew zaydas agar nasayir malay. He's going to be winnowing tonight. So he's going to be winnowing tonight. So therefore, what you should do is v'rachatzta, you should bathe. V'sachta, you should anoint yourself. Maybe that means put on makeup, even on a simple level. The samta simlo sayich, dress up really nicely. on you. And you just go down into the grain area, the granary where he's going to be with the winnowing. And al tivadi leish ad kalos elech of lishtas. Stay in the wings, stay hiding. Don't tell anybody you're there until he finishes eating and drinking. He's going to be alone. Vehine yibishachvai, when he lays down to go to sleep, v'yadaitas hamakam, you're going to know exactly where he's going to be sleeping. And why would he be sleeping in an area where grain is harvested? Why do you sleep in his home, in his bed at home? There's reasons for that we'll get through, but let's get through this to the end, and we'll go back and analyze these verses carefully. So you'll see where he sleeps, and then uvasa, you'll come there. Vigilis margalosav, you're going to uncover his feet, okay? Vuhu yagid lachas yirtasun, and then he'll tell you what to do next. And obviously, Rus is absolutely shocked at what Naomi just suggested for her to do. But Rus, with tremendous loyalty, and she says, okay, kol asher toimri elai esa, all these things you tell me to do, I'm going to do. What the heaven's going on over here? This is an interesting marriage proposal. Mm-hmm. You're going to go, you're going to get all dressed up, and you're going to come there when he's alone, in the middle of the night, you're going to wake him up by uncovering his feet, and you'll just sit there and say, what would you like me to do next? Wow, it sounds like really far out, right? Now, the sensitive nature of this suggestion, which, by the way, becomes a reality, that's what happens, it cannot be ignored. We can't just say, oh, it's learning scripture, it's, you know, it's just mechanical stuff, this is just how it happened. We have to, Naomi's plan, her daring plan, or her methodology of ensuring that Ruth gets married appropriately is, well, it's unconventional, to say the least. Right. And whilst I'm going to be the first to tell you that much of Naomi's decision-making goes beyond the realm of our understanding, as the Al-Sheikh points out, that Naomi had prophetic intuition. She's a very, very special woman on many levels, and actually she had this prophetic intuition. This was the right thing to do, so go argue with prophecy. Can't argue with that. It's not a rhyme or reason logical kind of thing. This is an intuition, of a holy intuition. So despite the fact we do have to have some kind of understanding, have some kind of some way of rationalizing or explaining what's going on over here. Now, there's an interesting vart from the Tzemach Tzedek that they say somebody once made mashke, whiskey, but not whiskey, I guess vodka, which was kosher l'Pesach. You can make it out of potatoes. So they made potato mashke, potato vodka, and they brought it to the Tzemach Tzedek. According to one version, one of the Tzemach Tzedek's own children went into the Pesach production business and he made this potato vodka. You know, Chassidim, Fabrengen, Selachayim. Someone said he didn't want to have it. So he said, it's kosher for Pesach. There's no... So he said, there is a statement from the great Gaon and Tzadik Rabbi Akiva Eger, who said that he would not permit Mashka on Pesach mitam komusle, for a hidden reason to him. A hidden reason. So that someone said it like this. He said, if Rabbi Akiva Eger would give a reason, I could look at the reason. I could argue with the reason, because it's lumdus, it's jurisprudence. Okay, look at the jurisprudence, either you agree or disagree. He'll bring his proof, and we'll see if there's other proofs. So what's that? They could argue with Rebbe Akiva Eger. But he said, what Rebbe Akiva Eger says, tam komos, is a reason hidden to him. It seems to, he indicates he has some kind of intuition, which is beyond simple rhyme and reason. So the Tzemach Tzedek said, well, the tam komos of Rebbe Akiva Eger, I can't argue. If he had that intuition, okay, if that was his intuition, so be it. So it's not as if we're not going to come and say, well, Naomi, I'm not so sure this is a good idea. I would have thought of better ways to do this. You know, just sending a young lady alone at night, all dressed up, to uncover some old man's feet. There's a significant age difference between them, and say, oh, would you like me to do anything else? Where do you want to take this, right? So there's an element here which is beyond the realm of our understanding, and that has to be acknowledged. We have to know there's an element of nevuah over here. Have at the same time, however, let's try to understand this to some degree. We need to understand this to some degree. And I think in part of understanding it to some degree, we're also going to be able to better appreciate the first verse, which we will study in depth this morning. We'll study that verse, first verse, and Be'ezrat Hashem in the coming classes, we'll go through the subsequent verses carefully, comb through them carefully to try to discover the deeper, subtle subtext and the other messages that are encoded into it. All right, so there's two general approaches here. The Gersonides, Ralbag, especially as is explained by Sheresh Yishai and Nachlas Yosef. So the Ralbag says we're talking here about Yibum. Yibum is a levirate marriage. So let me give you, fill you in the background quickly. And we'll need to understand this from Ralbag's perspective and Alshich's perspective, although they come at it in different ways. So the idea of a levirate marriage is that if a man and woman are married, let's just say for lack of better terminology, just to make it easy, we have Yaakov and Leah are married. Okay, Yaakov and Leah get married, and unfortunately Yaakov dies. So what's Leah now?
Widow.
A widow. Unfortunately, Leah doesn't have any children with Yaakov. So whether they were married for a year or 20 years, they didn't have any children. So now, even though usually when a woman is widowed, the old marital bonds are broken, and she's what we call free or single, so now because there was no children, there's a lingering connection. It's as if Yaakov's kind of mission or relationship or connection to Leah is not finished. And we'll talk about this soon. The Alshich says some really spooky stuff in the Zohar about this, quoting the Zohar, two different reasons in the Zohar. But on a literal level, there's still a marital connection. It's not marriage. She's not called Eshet Ish. She's not called a married woman, per se, but she's also not unencumbered or free. So we have this bond, this link, this connection. What's called in Talmudic literature, Zika. Zika means, forget that illness. Zika means in Hebrew a connection. There's a Zika. There's Zakuk. They're connected to one another. Who is she connected to? So the answer is, she's connected to his brothers. And his brothers, or one of his brothers, is supposed to ideally marry Leah. So let's say Yaakov has a brother named Esav. Esav's job would be to marry Leah and to have a child with Leah. And that first child would be named Yaakov. And then he would have a special portion of the inheritance of his mother's first husband, his uncle, he was fathered by that man's brother. But since he's the first child, it's as if the spirit of the deceased now is able to continue through this child. Because when a person leaves this earth and doesn't have any children, doesn't leave anything behind, something's wrong. There's a problem. The natural state of affairs is that when we come into this world, when we leave this world, we leave behind. We leave something behind. There's an incredible story. I told it in a sermon a few years ago. It's actually Rivki's grandfather, Rabbi Bukit, Alav HaShalom. So he was in visiting his daughter in California, and somehow there was some ad in the newspaper about a group of survivors from the town, from Chmelnik, where he was from. So he comes to this group of survivors. He left as a boy, went to yeshiva. I think a 14-year-old boy left, saw his parents for the last time. He was an only child. And he's there and he participates, and then he gets a call. Somebody, are you Chaim Meir Bukit? Yeah, he's Bukit. I have a message from your mother. And he goes and he meets this older woman, and he corroborates she in fact knew his mother. It's true, she knew his mother, and she says, I've had this burden. I don't know, it was 50 years since the Holocaust. I had this burden where your mother, her last words to me were, if you ever find my son, tell him the following. Ich hab gelost a Zecher. I left a memory. And so this woman, older woman who died shortly afterwards, has this fortuitous, unbelievable divine providence where they cross paths, and she tells Rabbi Bukit, your mother's last words, Ich hab gelost a Zecher. I left a memory. And she didn't even know that he survived. She couldn't know she survived. And of course, he had a beautiful family and grandchildren and great-grandchildren today, which number well over 100. Both his parents were killed. The whole town, almost everybody died in town. So this is the idea of lazna zecher, right? Leave behind. The children, that's the continuation. When we're not here anymore, our children are here after us. And so it continues. Here's a person who didn't leave anything behind. Right? Never had a child, never merited having a child. He got married, but didn't have a child. So that's the idea of Yibum. Now, generally speaking, Yibum is applicable only when there's brothers who are alive. So if the husband had brothers, there's an issue of Yibum. If the husband doesn't have brothers, there's no issue of Yibum. Broadly, much more broadly speaking, not within the terminology of halachic, what's halachically binding, the idea of Yibum could be expanded to relatives of the husband. Or closest of kin. So there is this notion of closest of kin. The concept of Yibum, appears very early on in the biblical narrative. Very early on. The first time we hear of the concept of Yibum, the idea of Levirate marriage, the idea of a marriage which has a connection to the past, is a continuation of a marriage that was, is with the story of Yehuda and his daughter-in-law Tamar. Right now there's a very interesting medrash that links together Tamar and Rus, and says that there were two women who sacrificed themselves for the sake of the tribe of Yehuda, says the Alkot Shemayni. Who were those two people? Who those two women? Tamar and Rus. Which tells us there's a link between what Tamar did and what Rus does. Although what Tamar did is much more outrageous and much more forward. She actually sleeps with her father-in-law. Now, this is not a subject, class on the subject of Tamar and Yehuda. I will only tell you that Tamar and Yehuda possibly did continue to live together as husband and wife, even though at one point she was married to his sons. And there's a very, very nuanced and sophisticated rumination, an edited talk from the Rebbe, in which he explains how that could have worked before Matan Torah. Not after the Torah is given, but before Matan Torah, and how the idea of a Levirate, not in the technicalities of it, but the idea of the Levirate marriage already begins then. That's the first time we see it. So there is such a concept, there is such an idea. Of course, the way things were before Matan Torah and after Matan Torah are very different, because before Matan Torah, certain things could be done, which are not technically, by the cut and dry of halacha, the way it should or shouldn't be done, but it was in the spirit of the law. Then the law is given, we have to follow the letter of the law. You can't follow the spirit of the law anymore. You have to follow the spirit of the law also, but you can never depart or deviate from the letter of the law. But that's after Matan Torah, after the law is laid down. Before the law was laid down, they knew of the spirit of the law and they could live by the spirit. A lot of the things that I'm speaking about now require a great deal of elucidation. And I'm not doing it justice. I don't claim to be doing it justice. I'm just trying to help explain to you what's going on here now with Rus and with Boaz, which seems off the charts. I'm just trying to give you the background so you have some kind of appreciation after making the disclaimer that there's much here we don't understand.
What is the Zohar?
Oh, you get to the Zohar in a minute. Mm-hmm. You like that, huh? You want to hear the Zohar. Now, there's a question that could be asked immediately off the bat. Yichud Pnuya, that you're not allowed to, a man and woman are not allowed to be alone. Even if a woman is not a married woman, you're not allowed to be alone. You know, and that if we violate Yichud Pnuya, violate this aloneness, invariably trouble could happen. And trouble did happen in the time of David HaMelech. But that was one of the decrees of David HaMelech, of Yichud Pnuya. So David HaMelech forbade it. David HaMelech obviously comes later. That's Rus's grandson. So this wasn't the case. Halacha wasn't applicable yet. So Rus is not violating the halacha now. Now this is not Tamar and Yehuda, which is before Matan Torah. This is Rus and Boaz after Matan Torah. And there is no violation of the letter of the law. The methodology just seems a little outrageous. It's just not what we would come to think of typically. Now, you have to understand that when we, however, either way we're going to explain or talk about this, any way we're going to mention this, as the Chelik B'nai Yehuda says, that once upon a time, the world was a purer place, and it was possible for things to be done, quote-unquote, l'shem shamayim, for the sake of heaven, without any kind of ulterior motives. People could do things which in today's day and age would be entirely shocking to us, and they could do it l'shem shamayim. In today's day and age, it doesn't even begin. People are not capable of that kind of l'shem shamayim altruism. The whole thing here is a balance of two very strange emotions. The sexual drive and the urge which brings men and women together is not a l'shem shamayim thing. That's lust. And here we're talking about a matter of this sexual energy here. This is like, it's Boaz and Rus is beautiful. The whole thing is, it's not a l'shem shamayim thing. We don't know how to sort of speak about this in the terms of l'shem shamayim, because on one hand there has to be desire, and the desire is, it's not a l'shem shamayim. It has to be physical desire. Without physical desire, it's not possible for anything. You know, nothing can happen, so to speak, without that. But on the other hand, once upon a time, these people were very holy. These are prophets, people that Hashem spoke to. People living an entirely different level of consciousness. It was possible to have this balance of, on one hand, l'shem shamayim, for the sake of heaven. On the other hand, things which require libido and sensual lust and desire. And somehow they're able to live together, or they can occupy the same space. And don't ask me to explain it to you, because I don't understand it. But there is such a concept. Mm-hmm. I think we can recognize that it's a concept that's somewhat beyond us. We're not able to think of this in a personal way and say, oh yeah, I can identify with that. But at the same time, we can understand there could be such a thing. This is when we talk about tzaddikim and the way the righteous men and women cohabit and so on and so forth, we're kind of venturing into that unknown territory for most of us. So Rus, the safeguards that became necessary subsequent in the time of Rus, it's a very early time in the development of Jewish spirituality. People generally live with a much higher level of intuition, much higher level of consciousness. People didn't need a siddur to daven to. For them, speaking to God was a natural thing. They knew how to emote. They knew how to tap into the inner rhythm of the soul and pour forth in prayer. It was a different time, different reality. And the fact that Chazal, our Nevi'im, our prophets talked about this, and Chazal built and understood that all of the Torah was built on these stories, is the biggest evidence that they're not what we think they are. They're not just little stories. This is not a Dane for a Hollywood Trist. This is sacred scripture. So sacred scripture has to be understood as sacred scripture, which means we approach reverentially, without superimposing ourselves, chas v'shalom, over this, without seeing ourselves or seeing our own life's experiences or seeing some soap opera unfold over here. And at the same time, there is a pshut shel mikra, there is what actually happens. So both of these, all this has to be understood together. So going back now to the business of Yibum, so Rus was married to Mahlon, and Mahlon had a brother named Chilion, and they're both dead, and Elimelech is dead. So there is no brother to speak of. But there is closeness of kin. Elimelech has family. Elimelech was like a leader of his generation. Boaz becomes a leader of his generation. They're cousins. There's a relationship. So there is a blood relationship here, not with Rus, but with Rus's erstwhile husband. And because there's a blood relationship, so Naomi feels that Rus should be dealt with or handled in a Levirate fashion. Somebody from the family should be redeeming the spirit of Mahlon and should be taking care of Rus. It shouldn't just be an ordinary shidduch, or at least, if nothing else, it should be ruled out before they move on. So this is the way the Ralbag explains this, and he emphasizes that there's a deep connection here to Tamar. I'm going to come back to this soon. But I want to share with you the words of the Al-Sheikh. The Al-Sheikh also has a different approach here. He says, there is a sweep of history, but it's not the sweep of history of Tamar, who's related not to Rus, but rather connected to the tribe of Yehuda. Boaz is actually a great-grandson of Tamar. This is Tamar's children, right? This is Yehuda's children, because Yehuda has two children. They die. Aaron, Onan die. Shelah is his third son, who lives, but Shelah does not produce the Davidic line. Boaz, Elimelech, they're all grandchildren of Peretz, because Tamar has two children, twins. Her twins are called Zarach and Peretz. So Zarach and Peretz, this is the children, the bloodline of Peretz, which is one of the twins that's born from the union of Yehuda and Tamar. Okay, so the Yalkut Shemaini sees a connection between Yehuda and Tamar and Boaz and Rus. And Tamar does something which is unconventional, to say the least. And Rus, after Matan Torah, is doing something much less unconventional, but unconventional nonetheless. So there's a relationship. That's how this is the prism that Ralbag takes. Ralbag says you need to understand this through the prism of a sweep of history that takes us back to not the ancestress of Rus, but rather the ancestress of Boaz, which is Tamar. Okay, that's the sweep of history. Emphasis here on sweep of history. An emphasis here on seeing this through the prism of not only what is, but what was. Because the Bible is considered to be a continuum. Well, it's based on the Medrash. I'm not playing anything. This is not my stuff. this is what the Medrash says, and Ralbag builds on that. Now, Al-Sheikh has a very different way of approaching this. And he says there is a sweep of history here. And there is a reason that we can understand that things are unconventional in being able to obtain, and yet we can marry this to the idea of L'shem Shemayim. What's that? He follows not the ancestry of Boaz back to Tamar and Yehuda, but the Al-Sheikh follows another Medrash which speaks about the ancestress of Rus. Who's Who's Ruth's ancestress? She's Moabite. Where does the nation of Moab come from?
From Lot.
From Lot. And how did that nation come about? Because Lot's daughters slept with their father. And the older daughter was very brazen and open about it. She says, Moab, it's Moab. This is daddy's baby. Now, the younger daughter, who was Ammon, just says my nation. Doesn't say my father, but there's actually a very righteous woman who comes from Ammon also. And so the Medrash says that the whole story of Lot was that two extraordinary pigeons, this is what they're called, two extraordinary birds should come forth. Who are these two extraordinary birds? Great heroines of the Jewish people. One from Ammon and one from Moab. Who's from Moab? Rus. So Rus's ancestry comes through something very unconventional, to say the least. Right? It's like, really? Avraham Avinu was so ashamed. He moved away from Lot because people said what Lot did. He moved away. But the Gemara and the Medrash tell us that L'shem Shamayim Niskavnu, that they didn't mean to be incestuous, that they really believed that all of humanity had been destroyed. And there was no future for the human race if they wouldn't do what had to be done. And they said, there's no way we're going to ever get a father to do this. And they found a jug of wine in a cave. They said, oh, they saw this as a sign of heaven, a jug of wine in a cave. And they just plied Lot, with who had just lost his wife, and he was probably very miserable. They plied him with wine until he didn't know what he was doing. And then they did what they did, and that's how these pregnancies were achieved. But they said, L'shem Shomayim Niskavnu. They meant this for the sake of heaven. There's an incredible story in the Tshuvas of Reb Moshe Feinstein, who wasn't a storyteller usually. He writes halachic responsa. But Reb Moshe says that when he was a Rav, he was a Rav in a place called Luban. So, not a big city, a small city. And then eventually it was under communist dominion, and the communists moved in. Of course, they shut down the mikvaot, and that's why Reb Moshe had a son, his name is Reb David, and then a son afterwards, his name is Reb Reuven, and they're like 7-8 years apart because there was no mikvah in town. There's no mikvah. So Reb Moshe's wife didn't live together. There's no mikvah. Anyway, Reb Moshe tells the story that in Luban, that there was a very odd story. It was the Parsha that talks about Lot and what happened to Lot. Parshas Vayeda. And there was a fellow who was mocking the daughters of Lot at the Friday night dinner. He was making fun of them all night, putting them down, making fun of them. And that night he had a dream. And the dream, two women came to him and they said, you should know that we will ashamed Shomayim Niskavnu, that we did this for the sake of heaven. And because you mocked us and because you made fun of us, you'll never speak again. He woke up the next morning unable to speak. He couldn't, his jaw had become dislocated. And he had like some kind of sudden illness, and he died the next night. And in the dream, they said to him, we publicized that this came from our father because we knew in the future people would come along and say, God made them pregnant. It was an immaculate conception. And we wanted to make it clear that there's no such thing, and that's why we did this. That's what Reb Moshe writes a story. And he says, it happened. I said, I know the person, and the person died that night. So it's not a good idea to make fun of biblical figures, even the daughters of Lot, especially because sages tell us L'shem Shemayim Niskavnu. I know biblical criticism may be very popular, and it's fun to poke fun, but it's really not cute. It's not smart. We treat these texts reverentially. This is holy, this is sacred. And that's a key part of understanding whatever we're going to talk about today, that we're dealing here with something which is beyond, to some degree, the realm of our fathomability and understanding, but also that we're dealing with something which is Kaddish, something which is holy. This is Hashem's Torah. It's sacred here. And the ideas that are being conveyed to us are sacred. So the Al-Sheikh says that part of Naomi's prophecy in being 100% certain that Ruth was the chosen one, and she was the one who was going to become the progenitress of the line of royalty, through whom Peretz, who's going to be the father of Mashiach, that he was 100% certain of this is the one. And Naomi understood that just as Moab, the ancestress of Moab, of Rus, did what she did unconventionally, that this would require something unconventional. It wouldn't be able to happen in a regular way. And that's why Naomi makes this brazen suggestion. Now, truth be told, Ruth doesn't actually do anything wrong. She just does something off the charts, that's all. Just comes and wakes up man in the middle of the night, uncovers his feet. You want to do anything about this? I'm just saying. Like, as if to indicate there's a Levirate connection. But the Levirate connection, of course, is that if the marriage is not to be consummated through a Levirate way, then a shoe has to be removed. Right? It's called the Chalitza shoe. So that's the feet. So therefore, she uncovered his feet, which is Levirate. Are you going to do your duty or not? And if Boaz would not, then Naomi would say, okay, I know you're the one. I know there's going to be somebody from the house of Yishai or somebody from the house of Elimelech that will eventually marry you, and there will come the seed of Beis Yishai and David. It will come, and I know you're the one. And I thought it was Boaz. So I'm not 100% sure of this. I know we have to do something brazen. I know this is not going to, conventionally, this is not going to happen. But my hope is that in an unconventional way, something extraordinary can unfold. An extraordinary can unfold where really the Rebbe of the Jewish people is the greatest Jewish leader at the time. There was no Melech, but it was like a Rebbe. The Rebbe's going to marry a convert from Moab, the despised nation. I'm like, how could this ever happen? So the truth is the union that's going to be unfolding between Boaz and Ruth is so unconventional that it requires an unconventional approach altogether. So this is the two different approaches, Auschwitz approach and Ralbag's approach, both drawing on the sweep of history, and that Naomi was basically inspired by the historical precedence of Ruth's ancestry through Moab, which was L'shem Shomayim Niskavna, for the sake of heaven, or conversely, the ancestry of Boaz, and that Boaz would understand and appreciate because that was his ancestry. Now, Boaz is a great Torah scholar. He knows both stories. He knows his ancestry. He knows his story. He knows Ruth's story. And Naomi was ready to kind of, she was betting that Boaz would just get it. Which it tells you something about Boaz also. You have to be a pretty extraordinary guy to get woken up in the middle of the night and just like snap into it. Right away, get it. Like, and she expected him to figure it out right away. That uncover his feet, Levirate, Moabite, house of Yehuda, Tamar, daughters of Lot, put the pieces together and say, right, okay, I guess this is what has to get done. So this is the background behind the story that's going to be unfolding. I wanted to share with you something very interesting, going back to the Ralbag's approach. David, I need Bereshis. This is Vayikra. Sorry to trouble you. About Ralbag's approach that this is talking about, specifically the emphasis on going back to Tamar, right? About Tamar. So I want to talk about the birth, actually, because there's something very interesting that unfolds with the birth of Tamar's twins, which is also kind of emphasizes the reality of what we call unconventional. So I don't know that. Thank you very much. I don't know that this is per se connected. This is a little bit. I'm doing this by myself, drawing the link between. But I mean, you'll hear. Okay, this is Bereshis 2, and you Bereshis 1. David, 1 star. So we know that Tamar, through Yehuda, founds the line of David HaMelech, the Mashiach. And then there's a story with that birth. And the fact that this birth is discussed, there's two multiple births in the Torah, and they're both discussed at great length. One is the multiple birth of Yaakov and Esav. And what do we find there? A wrestling, a dispute, right? Who's going to come at first? And there's like a similar dispute when it comes to, no, you know what, David, you were right. Sorry. When it comes to the multiple birth of the children of Yehuda through Tamar. So in Parshas Vayeshev, where we have this, you know, the story of Joseph unfolds, and then Joseph gets sold, and then the spotlight goes off Joseph, and it goes on to Yehuda. Yehuda has fallen out of favor with his brothers. They're very disappointed with him. They blame the sale of Yosef on him. And then we have Yehuda's whole story. He goes, and he marries, and he has children, and then the children die. He gets them married, and the two of them die, and so on and so forth. And then Tamar does the unconventional thing, which actually turns out Yehuda's saying, she was right, I was wrong. I didn't take care of her. I turned my back on her. and it was like this Levirate situation, which I'm not going into. The Rebbe actually explains it in stunning detail how it could work before Matan Torah. Okay, so then we have this, after this whole story is finished, we have this pregnancy. And it comes to this pregnancy, so it says that there's a scuffle between the two babies, and one baby sticks a hand out, and right away the midwife ties, I guess she knows in this family there's like issues of the firstborn, you have to know, she ties a scarlet thread, and then the baby pulls his hand back in, but a baby comes out and he doesn't have a scarlet thread. What happened? The other twin managed to get out first. The two fighting to get out first. And so, she says, "Mat vatoimer, ma paratzta olecha paretz." Look at unbelievable strength you have pulled together, like from the term uforatzta. Vayikrashme paretz. And then it says, "Va'achar yotza achiv." Then the brother came out. And al yode ashani, he had the crimson thread. Vayikrashme zorach. So the Agadas Bereshis says like this. Peretz zeha Mashiach. Peretz is Mashiach. This is the future of Mashiach. Shenema, because it says about Mashiach, Allah ha-poyretz lefneim. The poyretz is the one who breaks down barriers. Mashiach will be anything but conventional. Mashiach will not come slowly. The Gemara is very clear. Mashiach is not going to be a slow process. We slowly come back and start to rebuild the state, and then eventually we start to get respect by the nations, and then eventually we conquer our enemies, and then eventually, slowly but surely, finally, we vote Mashiach into office, and then Mashiach. The Gemara is very clear in telling us that it will be kehedifying, blink of an eye. No, is the current situation, is everything ripe for Mashiach to come? Are we in Israel now? Sure. But is this the actual process of Mashiach's coming? We believe most definitely not. There is an opinion, a school of thought, that this is of religious Zionism, that believes that this is part of Hashem's way of bringing Mashiach. The Rebbe believed that was a contradiction of two open statements in the Gemara, and that's not the way things are going to be. Rather, the Pasuk says, Allah ha-poyretz. It will be anything but conventional. Mashiach's coming is a non-conventional moment in history. It's a paradigm shift where human history as we know it is over. And a new reality is about to begin. And that's how Mashiach comes, Allah ha-poyretz, the mover and shaker. It's like there's conventional warfare and then there's non-conventional. This is going to be a non-conventional kind of shift. So in the Sefer HaBohir, which was for a long time the only book of Kabbalah we had because the Zohar went into hiding, written by Ibn Chunya ben Akona, one of the prized disciples of Yeshua ben Yochai. So he writes over there that Zorach was called Zorach al Shem HaChama because of the sun. The sun shines. How do you say shine in Hebrew? Hashemesh Zorachat. So Zorach is from the term sun. What color is the sun? It's red. It's orange. Okay. So that's the sun always shines. Even when it's April in Toronto and snowing, the sun is still shining. We're just not getting to see the sun shining, right? In the sunshine state, where everybody wants to run away to in Florida, the sun is shining. And even when it's hurricane season in the sunshine state, the sun is still shining. We just don't get to see it. I remember a few years ago when we had the opportunity to do Birchat HaChama, which comes every 28 years. So if you remember, it was a pretty cold... pretty cold then too. And the morning of Birchat HaChama, actually, it snowed a little. And we didn't think we were going to see the sun. If you don't see the sun, you can't make a bracha. So I was talking to Rabbi Shachar a few days earlier about it. Rabbi Shachar wasn't sure he'll be around for the next Birchat HaChama. He said to me, "Meni, maybe looking to get a plane." I'm like, Rabbi Shachar, are you serious? You make a bracha? It's worth it? Make this one bracha? So actually, I made some calls. It's going to cost you a lot of money. Maybe we should do it anyway. We didn't do it, and the sun did appear. And everybody got to make the bracha. But that was just like, that was what he was thinking. You make a plane? Because as long as you see the sun, it doesn't say you can't be in a plane. It's going to be standing here on planet Earth. Maybe climb the CN Tower. I don't know. As long as you see the sun, you're okay, right? You have to see the sun. So the sun's always shining. What's not always shining? The moon is not always shining. The moon doesn't always... Now, the moon is always there. Mm-hmm. That's ridiculous that the moon disappears. The moon doesn't go anywhere. It just doesn't reflect any light. Mm-hmm. Because right now, at a certain point, planet Earth blocks the sunlight. So when planet Earth blocks the sunlight, what comes through to the moon? Nothing. So if you live on the moon for half a month, you could be living in the dark. And then half a month, you live in whatever light you get from the reflection that refracts or bounces off the moon. So the moon is not always shining. And therefore the Sefer Abor says that the Levana, the Peretz, is called Al Shem HaLevana. Peretz comes to the term moon. Why? Because he says the Levana, this is a quote, is Nifretzes Le'itim. It gets broken down. V'nivnes Le'itim, it's built up. Now, not the moon, but the shine, the radiance. The moon, the body of the moon doesn't go anywhere, of course, but it doesn't reflect light. So the moon in this heavens, sometimes it's big, full luminous moon, and sometimes you don't see any moon over there. So that's what Sefer HaBor says. And the Rebbe once suggested that the connection between sun and moon is not just about the sun that shines all the time and the moon that doesn't, but rather, he said, that this is also connected to what's talked about in the teachings of Chassidus, starting from Maimorim of the Alter Rebbe in Ur HaTorah and Parshas Veschanan, but many, many Maimorim subsequent, that the sun represents Avodas HaTzadikim. Avodas HaTzadikim is, you know, we call Tamidim Kesidron. Here's the tzaddik, doesn't miss any dotting any I's, crosses all the T's, goes through life, every opportunity is realized. It's a conventional Avodas Hashem. The tzaddik is conventional. He does everything according to the conventions of Torah. But then there's what's called Avodas HaBaal Tshuva. The Baal Tshuva is not conventional. Because the Baal Tshuva was doing who knows what. And then he did Tshuva, then he became a returnee. And we know that B'makim Shabale Tshuva Aimdim, in the place where the Baal Tshuva returnees to Judaism, those who rehabilitated their spirits, where they stand, Afilu Tzadikim Gemurim, even full Tzadikim, cannot stand. Why? Because there's a virtue in the non-conventional energy of the Baal Tshuva. And in order for Mashiach to come, incidentally, the Zohar says Mashiach's great accomplishment will be to bring Tzadikim to do Tshuva also. Mashiach also la'asavet Tzadikaya b'tiyufta. Mashiach will bring the Tzadikim home too. But they never left. Wait till Mashiach comes. You'll understand what that means, that even a tzaddik can do tshuva. So in other words, there's the conventional approach and the non-conventional approach. Mashiach is all about tshuva. It's non-conventional. It's not a slow process. It's a paradigm shift, which is what a Baal Tshuva is, a paradigm shift. A person lived a libertine life, a life which was devoid of Torah mitzvahs, and all of a sudden turned things around. And incidentally, Baal Tshuva can come to a much higher level because of that. Because they're able to elevate a dark reality that the tzaddik never knows.
Is this the first Mashiach or the second?
The Mashiach. Let's not confuse ourselves with first and second Mashiach. So, Ben Yosef and Ben David. The Mashiach.
Okay.
The Mashiach we're all waiting for. The Mashiach who's going to bring the curtain down on misery and suffering. The Mashiach who's going to usher in an era of blessed peace and prosperity and global God consciousness. That Mashiach. So this Mashiach is non-conventional in every way. And therefore, it was understood that who is going to be the progenitor of Mashiach? Peretz, not Zorach. Zorach is amazing. He's very cool. He's really a great tzaddik. He shines with a greatness. He sets and rises on a daily basis, does everything he has to do. But that's not non-conventional. You want to see a massive shift, a turnaround, literally subatomic transformation that only Mashiach can accomplish. And that's only Peretz. So Peretz, who arrives in a non-conventional fashion, because Zorach starts out, you know, he sticks his hand out, he's on the way out. And then his hand goes back in, and all of a sudden Peretz somehow, that's almost scientifically impossible that a birth should begin, which means a child engages, is making his way out of the womb, and then the other child should come out first. In fact, I think most doctors, most OBGYNs would tell you that that is impossible. As we know it, it's not possible. Clearly, the Torah says it happened, but something extraordinary. It's an amazing feat that we couldn't explain. So that's why it's called Peretz. And that's the moon. And that's the Baal Tshuva. And that's the father of Mashiach. So now all of a sudden it starts to make a little more sense. Tomer does what she does unconventionally. It's not the conventional nice shidduch. Yehuda's a nice man, Tomer's a nice woman, maybe we should get married. This is not a regular shidduch. And it couldn't happen in a regular way. It requires unconventional events, extraordinary events. And only because of this extraordinary nature does this union come about. And then even in the birth of what who will be the progenitor of Mashiach, it has to be unconventional. Peretz, ma paratzta. There's a Olah ha-peretz. There's this moving and shaking, this unbelievable kind of behavior which doesn't fit on the charts. So now, what drives Tamar?
Yeah.
What drives Tamar is a spirit which is totally beyond. Because Tamar, she senses that.
She knew.
Yeah, she knew. She's motivated by a higher force. And she was an extremely holy woman. And it required a tamar to bring about a messianic foundation, a messianic root. So now when you think about all this, especially as the Rebbe explains this, well, I'm connecting this myself, but it seems to me so obvious. And then you look at Ralbag's approach and say, aha, so that's how this has to happen. Understand? Like that's, so that's why Naomi, this maybe helps us understand Naomi's prophecy. How, why Naomi is so certain. Naomi says, yeah, this is, it will never happen that the Rebbe of the Jewish people is going to marry this Moabite princess. You know, she'll marry some nice guy. He's 80, she's young. It can't happen. Conventionally, no shadchan will come over. The shadchan will say, oh, do I have a match for you? He say, oh, you have a match. Well, let's talk about it. The match, it wouldn't even make it into shidduch talk. It's off the charts. And Naomi knows that even if she would go and speak to Boaz, it was so unconventional. This had to happen unconventionally. That Naomi just shows, Boaz, Ruth is just going to be there. And uncover his feet, and all of a sudden it's going to click. And Boaz is going to say, but of course. But of course. Yes, that's what the prophets were told. Yes, this is how it has to be. Naomi was betting that Boaz would be intuitive and spiritual and wise enough to make that happen. And she didn't feel she could go speak to Boaz because Boaz didn't come and greet him. She came home. Boaz never invited her to the house even once. The relationship was strained. We talked about that in the beginning, various reasons why Boaz didn't, why Boaz felt he couldn't make overtures. He was very, very reticent, very careful. Boaz is like the master of propriety, if you think about the story of how careful he was. Keeps this enormous distance in him and Ruth. He shows her kindness, but nobody should have any kind of thought that he was even thinking in that direction. So this master of propriety, this tzaddik with the polished buttons, was exactly as he should be. Every I dotted, every T crossed, he's the Zarach of the world. But he has to meet Rus, who is really like a peretz, but not in, she's unconventional. Moabite princess, coming from an idolatrous background, marries this nice Jewish boy who runs away and he dies and she should have been over there. And Rus's whole story is unconventional. And it's the unconventionality of Rus's story that sets her up for this moment, and it's this unconventional encounter which ultimately engenders what's going to follow, which changes world history, which sets in motion the Davidic line and eventually Mashiach and the transformation of reality forever. So when you put it this way, like as much as we don't understand, as much as it can't make sense, it has to make sense. And the same is true with from that perspective, as Alshich speaks of it, the connection that we have between the ancestress of Moab, of Rus, and how that comes about, and ultimately it's the seed of Avram Avinu. It's the seed of Avram that has to come back. Lot was Avram's protege, right? So it had to come back eventually. And all this comes back. It comes back to form the future, which is the bringing of Mashiach. So going into, if you want to go into the details, say, what's the obvious questions on this verse? The verse is rife with contradiction, and especially keeping in mind everything until now. V'toymer lo Naomi chamoisa. First of all, v'toymer lo, it doesn't have to say who, because the last subject is Rus. It says v'tibik banares v'teshev es chamoisa. She stayed with her mother-in-law. So if the last pasuk says she stayed with her mother-in-law, if I would write this verse, I would just say v'toymer lo. She said to her. No, but it says Naomi. And in case you forgot from 4 words ago who Naomi was, it says Chamoisa. Naomi, her mother-in-law. Why, there was another Naomi in her life? Who else did she have any conversation with? It's totally superfluous. As the Alshich puts it, he says, you think Shmuel HaNavi was just like throwing words around? He says, Ein Sofik Leshos Libe Shmuel HaNavi Beruach Kodshei. Shmuel didn't use his prophetic intuition to write a book, which is Revi Hadvarim, Stam, hyperbole, poetry. You write the same thing over 6 times. Shmuel HaNavi, talking about prophecy, talking about scripture over here. It doesn't make sense. It says, V'tayim lo Naomi, Chamoisa, the mother-in-law. And what's the next word? She doesn't say daughter-in-law, she says, Biti, my daughter. For heaven's sake, why would you emphasize mother-in-law, next word say daughter? If anything, we know that mothers-in-law and daughters-in-law is not always a match made in heaven. In fact, the Gemara says that there is invariably an uncomfortability. So much so that when it comes to the welfare of the daughter-in-law, the mother was not even believed to say Eidos. The mother's not believed because there's issues. There are always, or most of the time, issues. It's an uncomfortable relationship for a variety of reasons. So if it's an uncomfortable relationship, and this is like a contradiction, you're emphasizing she's the mother-in-law, and she says daughter. That doesn't make any sense. What was Shmuel Hanavi trying to say here? And she says, Haloy avakesh loch manoyach, asher yitav loch. I'm looking for peace for you, so it should be good for you. Well, if it's peace for you, it's good for you. Yitav loch, good for you? You just said that a moment ago. It says the word loch, 4 words later. Avakesh loch, I'm looking for you. And then it says yitav loch. Why do you say loch twice? Totally superfluous. Totally unnecessary. So, the Alshich explains, and many other Mefarshim go along the same, the Igeres Shmuel talks about this, they're actually peers, they live together in Sfas, studied at the same time, and that the easiest thing to assume here, when you start reading about this brazen plan, is that Naomi is setting Ruth up for disaster. This is like a mother-in-law, a pure mother-in-law idea. Only a mother-in-law can come up with such an idea. She says, oh, I have an idea for you, I have a shidduch for you. How really? Do you, mother-in-law? I should do what? Mm-hmm. So we emphasize that she was Naomi, which means pleasant. Because we want to emphasize her name. That her name, the name Naomi, was emphasizes the concept of the pleasantness of her nature. That she was Midas Tevis. That's what she was known for. As the Tuv Tam says, that Afal Pi, even though Chamoisech, even though I'm your mother-in-law, Reitza Ani B'Tevasach, as if you're my daughter. So he goes on to say that usually if a woman is widowed, so the mother-in-law doesn't want her to get remarried again. The mother-in-law wants to feel like, she feels like then her son is like finished fully. She somehow takes some kind of comfort that she's lost a daughter-in-law. But the mother of the girl wants her to get remarried right away. She wants the daughter to be happy. So these two women have a very different approach of this third woman. This woman who was the widowed woman, the mother-in-law wants her never to get married. The mother wants to get married as soon as possible. So here we have the emphasis, Fatemu l'chamoisa, her mother-in-law, what did she say? Biti, you're for me a daughter. I want you to get married. And don't think I'm setting you up. I'm setting you on some crazy kamikaze mission to go meet some guy who's 80 years old when you're in your 20s or 30s. It's a ridiculous thing. I go in the middle of the night and uncover his feet. I mean, who knows what's going to happen over here? You can be abused on the way. You'll be attacked. The whole thing is crazy, off the charts. Trust me. I am looking for your welfare. Thank you, David. I'm looking for your welfare, and I'm trying to do what's good for you. And that's where the emphasis, the pasuk seems to be a contradiction, but it's the whole emphasis here. Don't think it's a contradiction. Don't think that this is a mother-in-law concoction, a mother-in-law plot. Biti, my daughter-in-law. And the emphasis, avakesh loch manoyach. This is for you. And don't think it's manoyach, I'm looking for marriage. Well, this is really for me. As the Igeres Shmuel says, lots of shaduchim happen because it's good for the shadchan. The matchmaker has his money to make, you know, so he's going after the shidduch because he's got to collect his fee. Well, sometimes relatives push a shidduch. The relatives think it's good for them. You know, once upon a time, these houses of royalty, well, the shidduch was about the house of royalty, not about the bride or groom. These little functional kind of matches. He says, don't think that this is a functional match. This is not for me. This is not about my family. This is not about keeping you within my fold. This is all about Ashiyitav Loch. It's Manoyach Loch. It's marriage, and I have only you in mind. I look at you as a daughter, not a daughter-in-law, and it's Yitav Loch. Please trust me. I want what's good for you. I know it seems weird, I'm going to tell you. I know this seems strange. You know that I have prophetic intuition. You know, Ruth, trust me. And that, jumping forward to the verse, she says to her, whatever you say, I'm going to do. In other words, Ruth, in her modesty, in her humility, in her incredible devotion, she knows that Naomi wouldn't just say things. If Naomi says it, she says, if you say it, I know. I can trust you. But this is an amazing conversation that's unfolding. And that's why Shmuel HaNavi emphasized it in exactly this fashion. Now, the Alshich says something else really amazing. He says that the Zohar states with regard to Yibum, that when a man dies childless, he leaves a piece of his soul behind with his erstwhile wife, with his widow. She actually possesses a piece of him. And the peace that lives on within her does not allow her to rest. It says, Haruach ahu mekashkish b'me'eha. It's as if it's clanging. It's like a bell. It's what do they call the bells? You know, when the clapper of the bell moves back and forth, what's it called? Okay, like there's a spirit ringing within her.
The
movement. The soul is unhappy. And there's no menucha. How does he find menucha? He finds menucha only when the woman either brings another child into the world, in which time his spirit passes from his widow into that child, and he lives on vicariously through that child, or if it's cut off, it's cut off, it's cut off. So today's day and age, we don't really perform yuma, it's very rare, but at least you have to then set the soul free. So when a woman should be in a levirate, has a levirate situation, she has to close this, because otherwise the husband doesn't have peace. I recently had a situation, this woman, very secular, I begged her to please do this. And she says, I spoke to my Reform rabbi and he said it's a bunch of baloney. The rabbis made this up. I'm like, Google it. They make it biblical. It goes back to ancient times. I even told her, I said, go to the Royal Ontario Museum. You see, even they have a chalitza shoe there. So she went to the museum. She says, you're right. There is a chalitza shoe there. I said, so maybe you do it, like to bring your husband peace. I'll think about it. She called back, I thought about it. I'm Reform. I'm not doing it. I'm like, what do you mean Reform? You're a Yid. You're a Jew. It's the Torah thing. Like, what are you doing? Like, anyway. I said, you change your mind, call me, collect. I'll do whatever I could to arrange it. I already spoke to the brother, who was not very excited about it, but he said, Rabbi, I'll do what you tell me. I'll do what I got to do. Right? So the Zohar says, it doesn't allow peace. The soul can't find peace. So this is all because, therefore, the Al-Sheikh says, Rus could say to Naomi, I know what you're doing here. You're just trying to bring peace to your son. You're worried about his spirit. His spirit is living on within me. I'm stuck with a piece of him. And you want to just purge that. You want to get it, you want your son's respite. You want your son's peace. Al-Sheikh said, no. Vatoymer Naomi Chamoisa, I am your mother-in-law. It was my son, Machlon. I know it's a piece of Machlon, but Biti, I don't see you as the one who carries a piece of my son, and therefore you have to do what I have to for my son. You're my daughter. Biti, you're my daughter. And therefore, halayavakesh loch manoyach. I am not seeking the peace, the welfare of my son. I'm seeking your welfare. I want what's good for you. I want you to be the progenitress of Jewish monarchy and royalty. I want the Mashiach to come through you. I want David and Melech to come through you. And actually, there's a medrash that says, avakesh loch manoyach. The manoyach that we speak over here is the rest. She didn't have much of a marriage. Boaz dies immediately. What's the manoyach? What's the peace she has? The peace she has when she sees Shlomo and Melech build the Beis HaMikdash. Rus lives on. And she sees from her children come the Melech Yisrael, and she sees from her great-grandchild, she sees the Beis HaMikdash built. That's the Nachas. That's the Avakesh Loch Manoach. This is Naomi's prophecy. Because Naomi said, peace. So euphemistically meant marriage, but there was no peace. Rus didn't really have the privilege of a fruitful, long, nice marriage. But Manoach she had. She had the Nachas that no other woman in the world ever had. And she saw her grandson build the Beis HaMikdash, her grandson being the Melech Yisrael, bringing peace into the world.
So then did they have one child?
Ovid, one child. And Ovid has a son, his name is Yishai. And Yishai has a whole bunch of kids. And one who is Rudy and unconventional. And nobody thought he was going to amount to anything. Some even said he was illegitimate. And then Shmuel HaNavi was told to direct to go to Yishai, very respectable family. And Shmuel said, Anochi Haroya, I'm the seer. And God said, really, you're the seer? Which kids are going to be? Because one son, the second son, all these handsome looking. This one, he said, Shmuel HaNavi? He said, this one? God said, aren't you the seer? Shmuel said, oh, okay. That's the one. That's and David HaMelech is chosen by Shmuel HaNavi. He performs the Mashiach. He anoints David HaMelech, and David HaMelech becomes the king of Israel. So this, but again, unconventional. Everything in the development of this line is unconventional. Rus's ancestry, Rus's coming to join the Jewish people, unpredictable. Nobody could have expected it would go this way. Tamar, Yehuda, Boaz and Rus's marriage, David HaMelech's being selected, everything was unconventional. Nothing followed what we would call the normal or predictable path. Because we're talking about something which is off the charts. We're talking here about ultimately the Mashiach. So that's what the Al-Sheikh waxes on, and he speaks about it. He says, there's another thing, he says, when a Gilgal sort of transmigrates from the soul that was into the soul that's born, he says, in a sense, what happens is the soul was the equal of this woman, it was her husband, and then it becomes her son, which means she rises. So that's another version of the Zohar. And therefore he says, Rus emphasized, Biti, you're like my daughter, Avakesh loch manayach, asher yetiv loch. What I seek here is your welfare, what's good for you. And so, Rus understands this intuitively. She trusts Naomi. She knows that she has her best interest at heart. There's no doubt to her. And she knows that she is Na'am, that she has beautiful ways about her. And because she has this beautiful way about her, and that's why we emphasize the name Naomi, emphasis on the name Naomi, because we emphasize that Naomi is this incredible, loving, considerate, sensitive, and compassionate person, Ruth trusts her implicitly, and she embarks on this very strange path, on this very daring and unusual kind of unconventional plan in order to realize her destiny is becoming the ancestress of David, of Shlomo, and ultimately the mother of royalty of Mashiach. Pretty incredible stuff, huh?
Papa and I were talking about